I'm WILL TV program director David Teal, your guest host for this hour of Focus 580. David Inge has the day off. For many, the internet revolution known as Web 2.0 holds great promise. Websites such as Wikipedia and YouTube are built almost entirely on user-generated content. Online blogs allow almost anyone to present him or herself as a crusading journalist. Creativity abounds as millions of amateur authors, musicians, movie producers, and pundits share their output with the world. Yet according to author Andrew Keen, this new participatory phenomenon threatens the reliability of information and puts experienced professionals out of work. Meanwhile, illegal downloads damage the music and movie industries with repercussions for the greater U.S. economy. And the cloak of anonymity provided by the internet makes it possible for marketers, corporate interests, and political workers to secretly manipulate public opinion. Andrew Keen has written a provocative book entitled The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. He joins us today by phone. We welcome your questions and comments, but we do ask that you keep them brief and to the point. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Good morning, Mr. Keen, and welcome to Focus 580.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you with us this morning. I wanted to talk a bit about maybe before we get into what's wrong with the internet, kind of talk about your background because you weren't always a contrarian when it came to the internet. And I'd like to talk about where you came from and maybe how you came to the position you're in now.
Yeah, and thank you for that introduction and an introduction to the book. It was very succinct and very accurate. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I've done a number of things in my life. One of the most exciting ones was being a pioneering digital media entrepreneur. My background really originally was as a music journalist, and I founded an online newspaper and then digital distribution network called AudioCafe.com in the mid-90s. It was one of the early websites about the digital music revolution. It was funded by an Intel SAP e-commerce startup. So I've been in this thing pretty much from the beginning as a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and music lover. I got into it because I was really excited that the internet provided a digital distribution mechanism not only for music reviews, but also for musical content. I'm not a Luddite. I like the internet. I couldn't have written my book without the internet. I couldn't live without the internet. What happened, though, that was what you might think of as Web 1.0. That was the period between about 95 or the early 90s and 2000 when the market crashed. The latest version of the internet boom, what people now are calling Web 2.0, as you described in your introduction, is reflected in the rise of user-generated content. And I'm much less keen on that, much less enthusiastic. I'm concerned not only that much of that user-generated content is worthless, but also that it's undermining high-quality professional content. In my book, I describe my epiphany, that the moment that I went from being a believer to someone who was deeply skeptical. It happened in 2004. At what's known as an unconference conference in Silicon Valley, where there were all these high-powered, wealthy digital media entrepreneurs running around talking about the democratization of media and the flattening of things, and it really woke me up. I think quite an entertaining description of that epiphany in my book.
Yes, and you talk about, of course, you know, the title of the book is The Cult of the Amateur, and one of the chapters is entitled The Noble Amateur. What I take from that is that there's a notion out there that somehow amateur journalists, amateur writers are seen as somehow elevated above professionals for some reason. I guess they're seen as being less biased or less influenced by other sources.
Yeah, I think that this speaks to a broader cultural phenomenon. I think it rests on, rather than perhaps the cult of the amateur, we might talk about the cult of innocence or the cult of the child. There's this increasing notion, I think, particularly amongst what I would call cultural radicals or libertarians, that the less you know, the more you know. The less you're associated with formal institutional structures, governmental or cultural or academic. Somehow, the more knowledgeable, the purer you are. So part of the assault on mainstream media has been by these Web 2.0 people who are assuming that if you work for a traditional newspaper or radio station or movie studio, that you're somehow corrupt or self-interested. And I don't think those things are true. I'm very, very skeptical and indeed critical of this cult of the amateur, this cult of innocence, on two grounds. Firstly, I don't believe that innocence or amateurism reflects any great wisdom. I'm not in, say, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's camp here. Kids aren't more knowledgeable than grown-ups. Amateur journalists aren't better journalists than professionals. And secondly, and perhaps even more concern here, is that behind this veil of innocence, this veil of the amateur, seasoned professionals are able to sort of peddle their own agendas by wearing the cloak of innocence, by wearing the cloak of amateurs. My biggest concern of this Web 2.0 revolution is that we're undermining the gatekeepers, the editors, the publishers, the fact checkers, the talent scouts, the people who keep mainstream, the ecosystem that keeps mainstream media relatively honest. And once we do away with that, all kinds of deception are much easier to perpetrate. And that's what really concerns me about this new media.
And, one of the targets of your book, of course, is the popular online encyclopedia, Wikipedia. I think it's a site that's visited quite a bit. I visit it myself quite a bit, as a matter of fact. For the benefit of our listeners, what is Wikipedia? How does it work?
Wikipedia is the reverse of a traditional encyclopedia like Britannica. At Wikipedia, anyone can write any entry, and anyone can edit over somebody else's entry. So there's no formal central editor or editorial board. We're all editors on Wikipedia. And what that has resulted in is, firstly, information which isn't always that reliable. But I think that's the least of the problems, really, on Wikipedia. The biggest problem of all is that Wikipedia has no context. It really does reflect the worst instincts of the mob in terms of the aggregation of information. So you have these very long and meticulously footnoted entries on irrelevant cultural figures like Pamela Anderson, the softcore pornography actress, whereas really important historical figures like Joan of Arc or Marie Curie or the great 20th century political philosopher Hannah Arendt have less meticulously researched, less lengthy entries. So the reality of Wikipedia is it's entertaining and in some ways, I guess, informative, but it skews information. It makes everything miscellaneous. It reflects, I think, the relativization of knowledge so that nothing is more important than anything else. The other thing about Wikipedia that really troubles me is that all the editors on it are anonymous. The organizer of Wikipedia, a fellow called Jimmy Wales, who's a radical libertarian, he will not reveal who his editors are. And my strong suspicion is that if we actually knew who most of these editors on Wikipedia are, we would find that it doesn't reflect most of us. It actually reflects a small cross-section of 20-somethings who have got nothing better to do with their time than edit Wikipedia pieces. So actually it reflects not the democratization of information or knowledge, but actually the appearance of a new kind of oligarchy, a really troubling oligarchy because it's anonymous.
Hmm. We've already got a caller on line one from Champaign. Line one, you're on the air.
Yes. I think that anybody who lives in the Champaign-Urbana area has to be somewhat attached to the academic environment here, and I think that a lot of people work for the university, you know, from administrators through faculty, through staff, and I think most people in this town take academia very seriously, take knowledge and information and rigorous research seriously, and that I find people here are very well informed. So at the same time, these are people I know who read the blogs on the internet, not because it takes the place of academia, because it expands people's information. I think if you look at what Verizon and AT&T try to do to get a monopoly on pricing for the internet, and it was not the mainstream media, wise or unwise, that uncovered that. It was the bloggers. So I'm not saying that we should get rid of academia. I'm saying we keep it, obviously. We keep our newspaper and our magazine outlets and all the commentaries, et cetera, et cetera. I am a great believer in scientific research and in academic scrutiny. And at the same time, I think we need the internet, because the intellectual oligarchy in this country, that includes the newspapers, are not the only place to get information. And as I pointed out, when it came to being able to control the web by these two corporations, it was only the bloggers who got the information, who read the bills, and who discovered that the internet was going to be controlled by these two corporations. So don't be hard on the internet. Think of it as just one more source of information. And I'm sure, sir, you even admit that you do not know all the information in the world.
Well, I think this lady's, I think she's making some interesting points, although I think she's a little bit muddled on a couple of levels. Firstly, I'm not suggesting we shut the internet down. I never said that. As I said, I like the internet, and I'm in favor of it, and I use it all the time myself. I'm certainly not in favor of shutting the blogosphere down either. My criticism is a cultural one. I agree that most academics in particular will use the blogosphere and do it quite intelligently. There are quite a lot of interesting bloggers online. I accept that. My concern is not with media literate people like professional academics. They can look after themselves. My concern is with a new generation of kids, what I would call the YouTube generation, who are growing up now without newspapers, often without television news or radio news. They rely entirely on the internet for their information. And I'm concerned that this generation is not as media savvy, as skeptical, as media literate as the lady is suggesting academics are. And I think that kids need to be taught this kind of media literacy. They need to understand that there's a fundamental difference between a blog and the New York Times. I mean, the New York Times, I accept, it can occasionally print stuff that's either inaccurate or even corrupt, but generally it doesn't, and it has series of layers of responsible gatekeepers who would do a good job providing us with accurate coverage of the news. The blogosphere doesn't. It's patchy, corrupt, and often inane. There's a fundamental difference between the two. The other thing the lady is, I'm not sure if she seemed a little confused or muddled about this AT&T Verizon thing. I think she's pointing to the network neutrality issue, which is incredibly complex and which it's certainly not an area which I'm an expert on, but it's certainly not as simple as she's suggesting.
Well, and appreciate the caller's question. And we also, we have another caller from Champaign on line two. Champaign?
Hi. Maybe you've already answered this question, but you were talking about Wikipedia. Is there an alternative you can recommend? And I'll hang up.
Thank you.
That's a good question. Well, I mean, the obvious alternative is Encyclopedia Britannica, which exists online now and is a standard conventional encyclopedia, and you have to spend, I think, about $60 or $70 a year to subscribe. And some people say, well, why should we pay for our media? Well, you pay for your books, you pay for your physical newspapers, you pay for your records. I think one of the things I don't like about the internet is it's giving people the illusion that culture, information, media, content should be free. And when it's free, when we don't pay for it, ultimately someone is missing out unless it's supported by advertising. So if you want your encyclopedia coming with adverts, then that's great. But if you want high-quality information, created by professional academics and experts, and you've got to be willing to pay for it because these people, like all of us, need to pay their mortgages and put food on the table. In terms of something between the pure open source Wikipedia and the traditional Encyclopedia Britannica, there are a series of alternatives emerging online. One that I talk about in my book is called Citizendium. That's Citizendium. It's actually founded by Larry Sanger, who is the co-founder of Wikipedia. He lost faith in Wikipedia and went off to do Citizendium. You might think of Citizendium as some sort of compromise between Wikipedia and the Britannica. It's more open source than Britannica, but it really rests on the authority of experts. And I hope that, I'm not sure if whether Citizendium will be successful, I hope it is, but I think what we're seeing is more and more sort of Web 2.0 style sites and organizations and publications emerging, which at the same time cling to the notion of expertise and authority. What I'm in favor of are the two worlds coming together. I do dedicate the final substantial chapter in my book to solutions. And what I want to see are experts, academics, professionals, people who are credible using the self-publishing tools of the Web 2.0 internet to actually bring more information and reliable content to the public. That's why Web 2.0 ultimately has tremendous potential. There's a dramatic difference between the inanity of MySpace or YouTube and reliable professional information created by academics or other professionals and distributed over the internet.
The thing that I find interesting about Wikipedia, or one of the things, is the speed with which it changes. And I mean, you can dial up a page and it will say one thing, and maybe 5 minutes later it says something else. I mean, on one hand, it seems like it's very quick at catching new developments, but on the other hand, it's also prone to hoaxes and
yeah. Well, I think it's profoundly vulnerable to our 24-hour news cycle culture. I mean, in fact, we might not even call it 24-hour. I mean, it's 60-second news culture cycle. I mean, in my book, I talk about stories which were literally changing on a minute-by-minute basis. And the problem with Wikipedia is without a formal editor, no one is in control. So no one really knows what the information exists or which information exists and how it's being changed. Again, you need a gatekeeper. You need someone to say, as with an important breaking story, let's hold off on this for an hour. Let's hold off on this for a day or a week. Let's make sure that all the information we aggregate is accurate, and then we'll put it out there. And the problem with Wikipedia, as you're suggesting, is that anyone who shows up at any given minute might see something different from the person who shows up the next minute. So again, it's profoundly unreliable. And it's fine if you're sort of media sophisticated, if you understand the process. But if you're a kid and you're doing your homework and you happen to show up at Wikipedia at 1 minute past five, before a story is changed, you're going to get a very different truth from the kid who shows up a minute later.
Yeah, and I know one of the people who had commented about this kind of changing of truth was the TV comedian Stephen Colbert, who came up with the term wikiality to kind of describe this truth by consensus. Whatever is true is, what the majority agrees upon. And
I was on the Colbert show a few weeks ago, so that was very entertaining. And I think Colbert satirizes this brilliantly. And ironically enough, if you look at the entry on Colbert's notion of truthiness, it's almost as long and as carefully researched as the entry on truth, the key word in the whole history of Western thought, which again reflects the absurdity of this. It's way too contemporary. We're way too close to this. Truthiness is a footnote to a comic act who may or may not be particularly important. Truth is the key principle in the whole history of Western thought. And Wikipedia, because it lacks a central editor, is unable to distinguish between these two things.
One thing that you had touched on a few moments ago is the idea of the 24-hour news cycle and kind of the inaccuracies that creep through because of the need to put things on the air as quickly as possible. But, you know, I guess from my perspective as somebody who is, I think, at least relatively media savvy, I mean, I have that complaint sometimes about the 24-hour cable news networks. I mean, they just seem like a lot of times when there's a breaking story, they're just on the air doing any kind of speculation rather than actual news.
So, absolutely. And I think the biggest weakness in my book, and I acknowledge this, I've done it before, is that I think I'm not hard enough on mainstream media. I think I tend to idealize it. I do that for two reasons. Firstly, because my book is a polemic. I'm taking a position. But secondly, because I tend to idealize the best parts of mainstream media, the New York Times, the BBC, CBC, Wall Street Journal, NPR, and so on. The problem is, I think, that in retrospect, if I was writing the book again, I would argue that the biggest problem with mainstream media is that it itself has fallen under the spell of the cult of the amateur, that it itself is doing too much reality television and call-in radio and a popularity contest like American Idol. So mainstream media is catering to popular opinion too much, which I think, again, often reflects 24-hour news cycle, that they'll simply provide news that they think people will want rather than news that's important, or news that is indeed like drama, news that does change on a minute-by-minute basis so it keeps people tied to their television so they'll watch more ads.
Yeah, a couple of nights ago at the Emmys, they gave an award to Al Gore's Current TV, which is also a television, cable television network that kind of depends in large part upon user-generated content. So
although I think, you know, I've done some interviews with Current TV, and they're based in San Francisco. I didn't actually write about Current TV in my book. I think they may represent one of the viable hybrids of the future. They do use a lot of user-generated content. On the same time, they have people, professional people, working for them producing high-quality content. So I wouldn't be as critical of Current TV as I would of something like YouTube.
I've been leaving a listener on the line for a while now. We'd like to hear from a listener on line one in Champaign. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm fascinated by everything that you're saying because my inclination is absolutely to be a terrible intellectual snob like you and to insist on the necessity of gatekeepers. There's a reason that there's such huge slush files at various publishing houses, right? Most people don't actually deserve to be published. However, I really think, A, that you're wrong that Joan of Arc is absolutely more important than truthiness. I think that the fact that Wikipedia has so many entries on things that so many people find salient itself speaks to their incredible importance, even if it is just in the moment. And second of all, I also think that your advocacy of better media sophistication and savviness and, you know, ability to read the media is absolutely necessary, but that's not going to happen when we have a public school system that is teaching to standardized tests and is not actually interested in teaching critical thinking. Now, I actually have been a TA in the history department here at the U of I, and I use Wikipedia in my classroom, of course, with the caveat that you cannot always trust it, and I myself have gone in to fix entries that were incorrect. I appreciate your polemic, but I also think the problem is precisely that it is a polemic and that you're not actually being nuanced enough about the importance of democracy.
Well, you bring up quite a lot of interesting points. Let me try and cover them. Firstly, I appreciate your general sympathy with my argument, and I appreciate the fact that you're an educator and that this argument resonates with you, and the fact that you are teaching your kids at the university degree of media savviness. You're encouraging them to use, or you're at least you're allowing them to use Wikipedia, but at the same time you're warning them that it's not entirely accurate. I think you should also warn them about intellectual property and that they can't just cut and paste, because I've heard from many academics and high school teachers that too many kids are just stealing their content from Wikipedia and assuming it can be theirs. I also agree with you that this is a debate which goes way beyond the internet. It's a debate about education and the value of education in our society. Much of what I'm writing about is not really a critique of technology or even the internet. It has broader sociocultural ramifications. So I agree with those things. You had a final point. I can't remember what it was.
I'm afraid
we, going? I also agree with her notion of the slush pile. You know, that the caller did sort of identify a very important issue. I mean, she called me an intellectual snob. I don't think that is a question of intellectual snobbery. We don't describe someone as a food snob if they prefer high-quality cooked food to something that's cooked by someone who doesn't know how to cook. And the same is true with creative work. One isn't a snob if one appreciates the fact that there are people who are better writers, better musicians, better filmmakers than others, and that only a small percentage of those people who want to be professional are able to be professional, are able to produce high enough quality content that it can be monetized. I mean, that's just a reality. It's got nothing to do with snobbery or elitism. It doesn't reflect anything except a sort of a constant throughout human history. And nothing's changing with today's internet. The so-called long tail, which Chris Anderson writes about, is an illusion. The vast majority of people online are not successfully making money out of their creative content, however easy it is to publish one's content on the internet.
Well, we want to remind our listeners who may have come in late, who our guest is for this hour, we're talking to Andrew Keene. He's the author of The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. If you have a question for our guest, we'll ask you to call in at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or you can use our toll-free line at 800-222-9455. And, you know, you talked about the monetization of talent. You know, what is happening to professional media types in this kind of in the Web 2.0 world?
Well, I think that it would be unfair to argue that people, that journalists or music professionals, music artists, TV people are being put out of work by the internet. I think that would be somewhat of an oversimplification, because I think the fact that fewer people are reading newspapers and watching TV reflects the fragmentation of society. The breakdown of the mass society of the 20th century can't only be blamed on the internet. In many respects, I think we could argue that the internet is a consequence of that rather than a cause. In reality, it's both a cause and a consequence. Having said that, though, it's a tough time to be a journalist these days. I mean, journalists are being laid off by newspapers. Most online journalists are not being paid. The reality behind the word blogging is that you give away your content for free online, you don't pay for editors, and that you hope that enough people will come that you'll be able to pay for that content through advertising. But as I show in my book, even the top bloggers, a guy in the top 50 out of 70 million bloggers, a Silicon Valley guy called Guy Kawasaki, he earned $3,500 from his blog last year. So if you're in the top 50 blogger out of 70 million and you're only earning $3,500, there's very little hope for the rest of us. So the reality is that as more and more journalists and record label executives are laid off, as it becomes harder and harder for musicians to earn cash with recording deals, so this Web 2.0 phenomenon is not great for them. The fortunes that are being made out of Web 2.0 are by executives at companies like Google and YouTube and MySpace, which are and their value is premised on the advertising that they sell around their product, their service, their technology. So the advertisers are getting rich, and the vessels for online advertising are getting rich. But the artist, the creator, the filmmaker, they're not necessarily doing well out of this technology. And in some ways, they're finding it harder and harder to monetize their talent.
We've got another caller from Champaign on line one. Champaign, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I had just one comment and one question. First of all, I know that you did admit that you were a little bit too idealistic about mainstream media. If you look at books on the bestseller list, I don't know if they're rich in intellectual content or if they are kind of dumbed down to pass the time and sort of turn reading into more of a leisure activity than an engaging intellectual enhancement. If you could speak to that, that'd be great. And the second thing is, do you comment in your book about web-based applications and how such a huge part of Web 2.0 is the fact that a lot of applications are moving onto servers and accessible through on the client side? I just wonder if that's touched upon in your book.
Could you, I'm not clear on the second part of your question. I don't really understand what you mean.
Well, just the massive availability of leased computer programs that are now available to the public.
Well, let me take the second part first, because my book is not really about technology. For people really fascinated to get into the engine of technology, this isn't the right book. There are lots of books about that. Mine is more of a sort of a cultural and economic critique of the implications of today's internet. The first part of your question was a very interesting one. I would actually disagree. I don't think that the bestseller list does reflect a dumbing down. I wrote a piece about this a few weeks ago. And when I did this, I looked at the bestseller list on the New York Times, and I found really high-quality, challenging books. Al Gore's book was on there. I think it was the Reagan Diaries were on there. Christopher Hitchens' polemic about religion. Richard Dawkins' polemic about religion. These are really heavyweight, serious, important political, cultural books. So I think that the bestseller book list actually reflects high-quality reading, and I'm all in favor of that. And certainly you won't find that kind of quality on the Internet, even at the best blogs.
Well, thank you to the caller for that. We wanted to talk, before we ran out of time today, we want to talk about the idea of intellectual property theft, because I think that's a theme that comes up several times in the book. Just as you mentioned, the ability of people to cut and paste seems to, you know, encourage that sort of behavior. And, of course, there's also illegal downloading of various kinds of media files. And so I wanted to kind of touch on that. Where do you think all
that
is?
Yeah, it's another really interesting and in some ways complicated subject. I often get the argument from people that, well, that we have a right to steal music because the record labels are ripping us off. $20 for a CD is absurd, and why should I pay $20 when all I want to listen to is one song? Now, that may be true. I mean, I don't doubt that the record business hasn't been that well managed and that the $20 CD, which hasn't been very well produced, doesn't deserve to sell. But that doesn't justify stealing. Just as if I object to, you know, the price tag on a new Italian sports car, it doesn't give me the right to go out and steal it. So if you don't want to buy music, don't buy it. And in fact, one of the benefits, I think, of the digital revolution is it's allowing us to buy Hook Track, which I'm all in favor of. I think iTunes is a great development. I am concerned more broadly about what I call a permissiveness around intellectual property. There's increasingly this sense, I think, amongst certain intellectuals, progressive intellectuals involved in the intellectual property sphere. One that comes to mind is a fellow called Larry Lessig, who teaches at Stanford. The one I have their cake and eat it. On the one hand, they're not encouraging people to steal. I accept that. But on the other hand, they are sort of constructing this conversation around intellectual property, which muddles it to such an extent that increasingly people believe that the large owners of intellectual property, the Disneys of the world, the New York Times of the world, essentially shouldn't have the right to control their own ownership of content. And I don't agree with that. I think that we need to teach kids, particularly kids, because they're the ones who are stealing the online music, they're the ones who are cutting and pasting on Wikipedia, and there are loads of studies which show that this is something that's growing and is really troubling teachers and university teachers, that we need to explain to kids that taking other people's content, whether it's a music artist, whether it's Disney, whether it's the New York Times, is just as unethical, just as immoral as going into a store and taking a pair of jeans or an iPod off the shelf and putting it in one's pocket. Now, there is this new culture of mixing, of mashing or mixing up, where you take content and you kind of impose your own digital signature on it. That could be interesting. But generally, again, I don't think it's a replacement for really valuable culture. And if Disney don't want to allow their images of Mickey Mouse or Pluto to be mashed up or remixed by creative artists, then I think Disney has every right to stop people doing that. I'm very skeptical of this notion of free culture. We should pay for culture, and culture ultimately is as physical as any other kind of commodity.
You bring up Disney, and I mean, this is they have done a lot to see to it that copyrights have been extended again and again
I'm not an intellectual property expert. I'm not in favor necessarily of lengthening intellectual property. I'm not suggesting that the intellectual property under today's law is not well enough protected. What I'm against is the other extreme, and I'm not necessarily in favor of Disney's intellectual property issues. I'm not really the person to discuss that in a great deal of intricacy. But what I'm against is this sort of this assumption now that when I listen to a lot of these people, this assumption that the culture should be free, and that if you don't register your content under the commons, the open commons platform somehow on the internet, that you're doing something wrong. I mean, I don't give my stuff away. My book is my stuff is sold in my book, and it's wrapped in my book. I'm not going to give that stuff away. That's the stuff that, you know, that's my intellectual content that pays my bills. And I don't think as intellectuals, as musicians, we should be embarrassed by that. I think that we need to be much more aggressive in the creative community in sticking to our guns and in protecting the inviolability of intellectual property.
And again, a reminder for those who've tuned in after we began the program, our guest during this hour of Focus 580 is Andrew Keene. He's the author of The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. We invite your questions at 333-9455 or our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a caller on line one from Urbana, line one.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm interested that you made an exception for your principle of always only having your content available in your books and sold, never free, that you came on a free-to-air broadcast station. There seem to be two themes coming out of your polemic today. One is that content or culture should be paid for, as you said, that culture should not be free or that it's only valuable when paid for. And the second was a repeated notion of, kids these days, which is kind of one of the oldest narratives we find in kind of people repulsed by new developments in the cultural landscape. Just to stick to the issue of culture being free, I think it's kind of very much an ahistorical view of the way that culture has developed. If you look back to folk culture back to the 19th century, the majority of cultural products were those that were shared, those that were came from the grassroots and the community. The notion of professionalization of music, professionalization.
Well, that's all very well, and I've heard this lots of times before, but how do you expect the creative artist to be paid in that situation?
But you're looking at it from one point of view.
I am, absolutely. I'm thinking of it from the point of view of the creative artist or the reliable journalist, and without those people, you don't have culture and you don't have information. Answer my question. How are we going to get paid if we give away our content for free? And by the way, let me also clarify something you said. I'm not giving away my content for free on this show. I appear on this show because I'm encouraging people to read my book. My book is a lot better than this. My book is very carefully edited and very carefully written. It's a much better product than me just talking spontaneously on the telephone.
Okay. I would hope so. To answer your question, I think you've got the wrong question. The question that I think is particularly interesting for us as a polity and as a community.
What do you mean, a polity?
As people engaged in a democratic society, that what we are interested or what is concern. So, what's of concern to you as an individual who has made your career of selling your cultural product is your personal selfish economic interest. That's rational. what I think is of interest to us as a community is maximizing the cultural goods available to us all.
And I think that the core argument in my book, and I agree with you absolutely there, but I think the core argument in my book is implicitly or otherwise the unintended consequence of many of the do-gooders in the Web 2.0 community. I don't believe these people are evil. They're not suggesting, they're not purposely destroying our culture in any way. But the unintended consequence is when you undermine the economic foundations for the creative artist or the professional journalist or writer, then you're undermining the very thing that you're trying to support.
Not necessarily. Only if you see it as a zero-sum game. What I would claim is that...
What do you mean a zero-sum game? And it's a zero-sum game if you don't pay your mortgage.
It's only if you have economic incentives for each individual artist that's the only...
What do you do? What's your living? How do you make your money? Because you're not talking real world. You're talking in a very abstract way. You sound like a graduate student or something. I mean, how do you pay your mortgage?
I'm a graduate student.
How do you pay your bills? How do you actually pay your bills? What do you do?
I teach. Now,
right, do you want to give your teaching away for free? Someone pays you to teach, right?
However,
I could make the counter argument that we're all better off with, high quality teaching, and why should we pay for it? Why should the state invest in any kind of education? Just give the stuff away.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, here in town, we have a number of different projects which I'm not personally involved in, but where people do provide free and cheap education of various qualities and serving various communities and areas that aren't provided through the formal system. So we've got the School for Designing Society. We've got Communiversity out of our local YMCA. So it is possible that you can have both a professionalized educational system sit side by side with amateur and volunteerist projects. Similarly, within media, we have two community radio stations here in town. We've got an independent media center which produces a monthly newspaper where they have a very rigorous editorial system. You've been pretty much setting up strong...
Yeah, I think that some of your stuff can work locally, but how are you going to get your information about the world? How are you going to get your information about Iraq? How are you going to get your information about Europe?
As I said, both can sit side by side. There are different places for each. But you, to kind of cast off and say culture must be paid for.
I think that cultural producers need to be paid. That simple, and I would certainly stick to that. There's no reason to give away your content.
Well, we want,
one shouldn't be seduced by the sort of the abstractions that this guy's talking about. Because ultimately, what he's leading to is suggesting that people should give their stuff away for free, which is absurd.
Well, I want to thank the callers.
And that was a good call, by the way. I mean, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I mean,
no.
Intelligent, but I think he's wrong.
Well,
idealistic. I mean, he epitomizes many of the pitfalls of this argument, this sort of general abstraction, this idealism, which I think is undermining culture rather than enriching it.
I think this is a subject that gets people passionate, and that's,
Oh, absolutely, and that's why my book has been so positively and indeed negatively received. That's why it's caused so much controversy, not only in America but around the world.
Well, we've got about 6 minutes left in the program and a couple of callers backed up here, so I'd like to go to line four. Is a cell phone, and line four, you're on the air.
Hello,
you're on the air.
Yes, I've been teaching journalism ethics at the university for 30 years, and I must say I really appreciate your comments and your book, because I've been teaching your ideas for many years. But I've been I've been fighting some students on this. The internet types, they think everything should be free, and why do they have to pay for this, and so on. So I really appreciate your comments, and I can't wait to read your book.
Well, thank you. And it's always, I always obviously like to get callers who are enthusiastic. One of the things I'm finding is there is a bit of a generational split. Not that I'm making myself as an old person or the caller as an old person, but certainly people who have a little bit of experience in a profession or a teaching, they're much more sympathetic than I think kids, high schoolers or college students who haven't had to be forced to become experts and understand what it's like to actually to be a professional and sell one's expertise in the marketplace.
And we want to, again, thank the caller. We've got another caller in Champaign. We've got just a few minutes left, so let's try to keep it brief. Champaign, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi. I would just like to make a brief comment about the caller previous to the one that just called. He was talking about how historically people traded their culture without being paid for. But I think what he's forgetting is that historically people were supported in different ways. Be it maybe the church was supporting some of our great thinkers, and they didn't have to pay their mortgage. I think since we live in a capitalist society, as much as I dislike some of the capitalist views, we have to realize that the whole world is different, and there isn't someone with a lot of money like the church or the state supporting us, and we have to make money. And whenever that argument comes up that historically cultures were traded more freely, it was in a totally different economic situation.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a really good point. And one of the things that I fear in this world is that we'll fall back into a sort of a patronage system, where we'll go back to the Middle Ages, we'll go back to a situation where the only way in which a writer can actually support themselves is if they find a rich patron to actually support them. And I would much prefer the market to be supporting them, the free market. As the caller says, it may not be ideal, but I much prefer the free market in terms of supporting creative artists and journalists than wealthy individuals, because ultimately you have a situation, for example, where wealthy individuals buy up all the newspapers in America and then just turn those newspapers into mouthpieces for their own particular interests. So this is a really relevant point, I think, and we should all look at it very carefully when we listen to the Web 2.0 crowd.
We've got just a couple of minutes left in the program, and I before we wrap up here, I wanted to pose the question, and what do we do about all this? Because the Internet's not going anywhere. So
yeah, the Internet's not going anywhere. I don't want it to go anywhere. I want to shut the thing down. I'm not a Luddite. The one thing there's lots of things we can talk about when we don't have much time with 2 minutes left.
Of course.
I think we need to be more personally responsible, more accountable. If we're addicted to online pornography or gambling or email, we need to recognize it. But I think the one thing we could do collectively to improve the Internet, to make it a more responsible and civilized place, is for all of us to give up the veil of anonymity. I think it's anonymity that is making the Internet so corrosive, so unpleasant, such a shameful experience, I think, for grown-ups and kids alike. So I would call on everyone, if you care about the Internet, when you go online, when you want to comment, when you want to generate your own information, when you want to get involved in debates with other people, reveal who you are. Because I think when we reveal who we are, we behave in a much more responsible way. And that's one way in which user-generated content will become more valuable, both in terms of our own self-generation and in terms of our readership. So let's fight anonymity. Everybody agrees with that. That's the real curse of the Internet today. And I think if we can do away with that, we'll be in a much healthier position to reform other aspects of this new digital economy.
You're noting in the book, I think speciously, that you know, it was entirely possible for perhaps you to have commented on your own book online, say perhaps on Amazon.com under the guise of a third party. And I wonder, did you actually do that?
No, I didn't, because, for self-interest, because I knew someone would expose me. But let me say, if I had commented, my honest opinion of the book is I think your listeners got to the heart of it. I think they're very intelligent comments. It's a polemic. It's not particularly fair, but it's designed as an opening to the conversation. This is a very important conversation. It's not really about the Internet. It's certainly not about technology. It's about media, culture, society. It's about the way we value information in this new century. And it's a critical conversation for us to have. You can't just listen to the Web 2.0 idealists. There needs to be another voice. There needs to be people actually challenging them so that we can really talk about these issues in a more responsible, coherent, and concrete way. And I'm thrilled that I'm having these kinds of opportunities and that people are enjoying the book and finding ways of discussing it in a more creative way. And I don't doubt that over the next few months, other people will come along and write books on top of mine, which add to it and add depth and richness to this debate.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it, and I want to thank you again for coming today, or for joining us today. Our guest during this hour of Focus 580 was Andrew Keen, author of The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture. It's available in hardcover from Doubleday Books, and I encourage you to check it out or pick it up. And we want to thank you again, Mr. Keen, for joining us today.